This is John McMurray of the Society for American Baseball Research, and I'm sitting today with Andre Thornton on April the 26th, 2019, for an oral history about his 14-season Major League career. And Andre, you were born in Tuskegee, Alabama, and ultimately you your family moved to Phoenixville, Pennsylvania, northwest of Philadelphia, and you played football, basketball, and baseball. And I wanted to ask you to start, why did you pick baseball? Why did you go into baseball as a career?
Well, John, you never think about when you're playing, high school and junior sports about playing professionally. At least I never did. When I was growing up, I wanted to be a teacher. Sports was just what you did. It wasn't with any ulterior motive, like, I'm going to, get to the big leagues or play professional football or anything like that. But we had a great sports town that I grew up in. So sports was very organized. We had great facilities for a small town. We had lights on our little league field when I played. We had one of the best Babe Ruth fields in the entire state of Pennsylvania. So we were always, we went from one sport right into the next as young kids from the time I was 7 years of age throughout high school. Yeah.
Now, in terms of your own interest in sport, I get the sense that football was more at the forefront of your mind back then.
Well, some thought I was a pretty good football player, football was big in our area, so you played and I played that since the time I was 8 years of age as well, and we had a good football team. I think we won our league my last year there, and I think we may have lost one game or something like that. And my brother, he played football there earlier than I did, and my other two brothers played after I did. But it was a good area, like I said, for sports. I mean, it was just a hotbed. That town was just a nice place to grow up, and people were involved in sports. I played in Williamsport for state championship games when I was in Little League. I played in the Babe Ruth World Series in Anderson, Indiana, which was for a 15-year-old kid, that was pretty amazing. I played in the Biddy Basketball World Championship in Gary, Indiana, when I was 11 years of age. So that was the kind of atmosphere that I grew up in, and of course my brother was a much better athlete than even myself. So I was just a fortunate one, the right time and right place, I guess.
Now, when you were 18 years old, you were offered a tryout with the Philadelphia Phillies at Old Connie Mack Stadium. And I know you batted against Phillies pitching coach Larry Shepard and had good success. Can you describe for me how that came about and also what it was like to have your first success with a major league affiliate?
Well, at that time, I was 17 because I had graduated from high school. And we were playing Legion ball and then played in some Legion All-Star games. The first team that in our Legion All-Star games was Jocko Collins, I think, or something like that. He was an ex-umpire who was scouting for the Houston Astros. And so he knew my coach, who was a former umpire in the semi-pro leagues back then, and he said, "Well, if nobody else signs his kid, I'll sign him." Mm-hmm. And that was the first of six games that we played in this Legion All-Star Series, and so every game I kept getting better and better, and of course all the scouts were there because John Matlack was also in that John and I played high school ball against each other, and then Buddy Harris was another outstanding player out of Philadelphia. So there were a number of guys that were being drafted. I think John went fourth in the draft that year, and so all these scouts were there, and I kept playing well. And John Ogden, who was the scout with the Phillies, who signed Dick Allen, Mr. Ogden, and they had bird dog scouts, you know, guys that would kind of let him know that, hey, you need to take a look at this kid, you know, that type of thing. So somebody told him that he needed to come down and take a look at me. So Mr. Ogden came down, he watched me, and he decided to, you know, that he wanted to take me to Philadelphia so that the Carpenters could see me and wanted to sign me. And so that's what happened, is that we went down to Philadelphia and I had to try out, and Gene Mock was the manager, and Mock, of course, didn't like young players anyway, but at that time they had Terry Harmon, who was a little utility shortstop up out of Triple-A that they were taking a look at, and Gary Sutherland. I don't know if you remember Gary Sutherland, who was kind of a backup catcher, but at that time he was a fairly high draft choice, I guess. But anyway, so we're down at old Connie Mack Stadium, and I, for whatever reason, I think I hit balls farther than at that time than I ever hit in my whole career, but hit a couple out of the entire stadium at that point. And only, you know, a few guys were doing that at that time. Dick Allen certainly was one of them, and BP. And Mock didn't care for that too much, so he told him to start throwing sliders. You know, and of course, I hadn't seen a slider before, but after I missed about five or six in a row, finally caught up to it, and Mr. Carpenter and Ruley Carpenter, his son, who had just finished up at Yale, was coming in to start getting involved in baseball, so they were out in right field, and so it was at that point, after meeting with them, and I went back home, and then I guess they decided, you know, they wanted to offer me a free agent contract, you know.
And when they did, I believe John Ogden found you in a pool hall, right?
That's right. I was in a place called the Golden Q, and, you know, I was a pretty good, you know, pool player, and we lived in a town that had the Valley Forge Army Hospital there, and, of course, that was during the Vietnam War, and so it was always packed with soldiers coming and going, and the guy that owned the pool hall, he would back me to play against these soldiers in straight pool or nine ball or eight ball or whatever it was. But that's how I made money during high school. I'm still, you know, I still know the guy. He's still alive that used to run that pool hall. That was Mr. Ogden walked in and said we want to sign you to a contract, and wanted to set up a time to meet with, you know, Mom and Dad and Nebs Griffith, who was my manager at that time in Legion Ball. So we set up a time and agreed on the contract, and they brought me down to Philadelphia to Connie Mack Stadium to announce the fact that, you know, I was signing, and Richie Ashburn and Byron Somme and some of the announcers for Philadelphia were all there and that type of thing. So yeah, that's how it all took place.
So once you were signed by Philadelphia, they assigned you to a club in South Dakota.
That's right, here on South Dakota.
And that was a bit of a culture shock, but at the same time, you also got to room with Toby Hera, I believe.
Well, yeah, there were five of us in the basement of a doctor's house in here on South Dakota. There was a guy from New York, one from Tennessee, one from Waco, Texas. Toby was from Marion, Ohio, and I was from, you know, Phoenixville, Pennsylvania. So yeah, we all stayed in the basement of this doctor's house out in Huron, South Dakota, and Joe Lynette was our manager out there. Yeah, and Hal Whitmore was the kind of roving pitching coach. Yeah,
and it was a year after you first entered the major leagues when you enlisted in the National Guard.
Well, actually, part of the whole signing, the way it took place is that once we agreed on the tournament, on the contract, which was late July, I think, sometime around there. Well, Philly said, "Well, we're going to sign you, but we need to get you into the National Guard, and we want to, you know, part of the contract they were paying for my college and getting me in the National Guard. That was, and I got a $10,000 signing bonus. That was the meat of the contract. And so my National Guard, I had to go away to play. I got in the National Guard before we went away, but I went away to Huron to play. And when I came back after the season was over, I had to go into the National Guard for active duty. And so I was sent down to Fort Dix, New Jersey. And that's where I had my basic at AIT. Yeah.
And it was during this time when you developed a connection to religion for the first time.
When I left for the military service, my mother gave me a Salvation Army tract and a little Bible. Mm-hmm. And I used to hear my mother listen to the radio, and you know, all of the, you know, preachers would come on, and one in particular, J. Vernon McGee, who was with Through the Bible Radio, who she used to listen to quite a bit. And at that time, of course, you had the Vietnam War going on. You had all sorts of racial tension in the country going on. You had, you know, it was a mess. You know, if the 60s, I'm sure you don't remember that, but are old enough for that. But, you know, I mean, there was... It was a different time in America, and I can remember, you know, saying to my mother, who's the justifier of all of this? You know, who makes sense of all of this? If all we do is, you know, live and die, and of course I had, you know, friends that died when we were teenagers growing up and that type of thing, so you saw all of that stuff around, but... my best friend was stabbed to death by his wife. He was 18 years old, you know, married out of high school, and actually, I had just come back from playing in a Legion All-Star game, and somebody was running up the street and said, "Marshall is dead." I said, "What do you mean, Marshall is dead?" His wife, and you know, I knew his wife, but they got in an argument, and she stabbed him. So that kind of stuff was real. And then, of course, Valley Forge Hospital, you know, these guys were coming back maimed and burned and all sorts of stuff, was because that's where one of the Army hospitals were, where they brought these guys back. So you saw all of that stuff. And you're trying to, as a young person, you're trying to, you know, what is this thing all about? And my mother said to me, "Andre, I can't answer all of your questions, but I can direct you to the one who can." And she gave me a Bible, and that was where I started to read that while I was in basic training. And it was there in that Army barracks in Fort Dix, New Jersey, that I accepted Christ as my Savior. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
You spent a long time in the minor leagues. You wound up being traded from Philadelphia to Atlanta, and you started to show some power pretty early on. And then you got traded to the Cubs for Joe Pepitone. You had a lot of movement around that time. And was there a point when you thought to yourself, you know, this is a lot for a young person to be traded and traded again, abandoning baseball?
Well, I probably had more confidence then than I did a couple of years earlier. the times where I really had doubt was when I was in A-ball, when I was in Peninsula, which is one of the Phillies' A farm teams, and the Phillies brought in a 35-year-old third baseman that, you know, was dropping down, working his way on out of the system, and they brought him down there because I guess they didn't have enough confidence to think that you know, that I was going to make it there. And plus, the manager was not crazy about me. And that's a story in itself. But anyway, during that year, they brought this guy down there to, and he was playing first, and I was, you know, here I am, you know, young, you know, 19, 18, whatever I was, and I'm not playing, he's playing. And so it just so happened, you know, one game where, you know, they put me in there to play, and Paul Owens was our farm director. So Owens had come down to watch us play one game. And so Cliff Johnson is the catcher for this. I think we might have been playing Raleigh-Durham. And Cliff is catching the game. And so I had met Cliff after I first signed. They sent us to the Instructional League. And that time, the Instructional League was a pretty big deal. You had so many A players, so many double A players, so many triple A players, and then you had at least four major league players that were assigned to the Instructional League. Because, you know, at that time, and you know, Rick Wise was there, Gary Sutherland was there, Terry Harmon was there, and Johnny Briggs. Those were the four big league players were there. Well, Cliff was with the Astros. J.R. Richards was there, and so that's where I first met him. And so here we are in A-ball now, you know, coming up. And so he's catching, and if you know Cliff Johnson, Cliff always was talking.
Oh, yeah.
And very, very outgoing and clowning and everything. And I'm struggling. You know, I can't hit the side of a barn. And he says, Andre, what's wrong with you, man? You know, you could hit better than this. And he said, I'm going to call a fastball. And this is what's coming, fastball. I think I let the first one go, and he said, what are you doing? I'm telling you, I'm going to throw a fastball. Well, the next one he threw, I hit a home run. And that just changed that whole season around, and then ended up having a fairly decent season, I think. And then the next year, I went to Double A, Reading, and with the same manager who didn't want me in A-ball, mm-hmm. Nolan Campbell, and went there and had a breakout season. That's when I knew that you know, I could play with anybody at that point. And on that team we had Bob Boone played. It was our catcher. Mike Schmidt joined us about halfway through after his college career was over, I'm trying to think. Billy Matlock played in that league. John Hart played in that league. They played on the same team. But there were quite a few major leaguers that played in that league at that point. Ken Griffey, Dan Dreesen with the Reds played in that league at that time. And there were, you know, a number of others. I can't remember all of them now, but had a breakout season. And from then, you know, there were no more doubts. I knew I could play with anybody at that point.
Now, is it fair to say that your fielding was ahead of your hitting at that point? Because I knew you were regarded as a very good defensive player.
Well, I was a good defensive player, but I couldn't throw. I had a bad arm, and I hurt my arm when I was in the service. We were playing pickup football with a couple pro football players who were also in the National Guard, and hurt my arm, and I couldn't throw. That's why I ended up always throwing from down here, for whatever reason. But yeah, that's when Reading was when I broke out as a hitter. Up until that point, you know, I was okay, but I think in Reading I ended up hitting 26 home runs or something like that, and really breaking out as a home run hitter and that type of thing. And then we went to Eugene, ended up doing well there too, and then traded to Atlanta, and ended up having a good second half of the season with Richmond in AAA. And so, you know, but Reading really was the turning point in terms of knowing that I could play.
Mm-hmm. When you got to Chicago, how did you feel about that particular club? They had a lot of talent, a lot of guys. I mean, everyone from Manny Trio to Bill Madlock, Rick Monday was there at one time, and but they never could quite put it together while you were there. And what was the disconnect?
Well, when I first went there, of course, we had the old guard.
Yeah,
you had Billy Williams. They were moving Billy. The reason that I came over there is that they were not crazy about Pepitone, and they were thinking of moving Billy to first base, uh-huh. Billy Williams. And so that's why they didn't need Pepitone, because I was going to be Billy's, in a sense, backup, because Billy, you know, was not a great first baseman. But so they had Santo at third and Kessinger at short and Beckett at second and
the old guard.
Right, and Hickman was at that time the first baseman, but Hickman was a utility player basically. And then Jose Cardinal and Wright and I think Mundy was there that year or came the next year, but Mundy was a center fielder, I believe, or left fielder. I think he switched off and on. But anyway, yeah, we had some good players there, but we didn't have any pitching. And I think one year, 73 and 75, we still were very competitive up until, you know, the last month of the season. Because one year we were all within 5 games of first place going into the last 2 weeks of the season. Mm-hmm. And the Mets beat us Seaver pitched one game of a doubleheader, and that, I think, allowed them to clinch. That was 73 or 75, whatever year that they went on to win the World Series.
That'd be 75 against Boston.
Yeah, because see, they clinched it against Chicago in Wrigley.
Ah.
I think Yogi was the manager of that team, if I'm not mistaken. But Cleon Jones was on that team, and of course Seaver and Kuzman were big on that team. I can't remember if John was on that team or not. Matlack, he may have been gone by then. I don't know, but. He may have been. I can't remember.
I think he was.
Yeah, but anyway, they had a great pitching staff, and was Gentry on that team as well? But another right-hander, little short guy, threw the ball very hard. But I can't remember if Frisella was on that team or not. But anyway, they had a good team, and they got hot. Because they were like 10 games out in August or something, if I remember correct. They got hot and ended up winning the thing. That was probably as close as we got. And I think either we were 500 or we were a game below 500. Uh-huh. And I think the Mets were like 3 games over. You know, I mean, that's how close it was, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Now, once you got, I mean, you were on the way up. 1976 was a rough year for you, and injuries were becoming a factor as well. And I wondered if you could describe a little about your time in Chicago before you were dealt to Montreal.
Okay. Well, the you know, I had a good 75 and really played well up until I broke my finger. We had a fight with St. Louis in September, I think, early September of that year. But I, the month before that, I think I was player of the month for the Cubs.
Yes, that's right.
And ended up having a, you know, a really good year, and looked like things were taking off, and of course missed the whole last month of that season because of the fight. I broke this little finger here, and so I didn't play anymore that season. And so we come into the 76 season, and we were having contract problems because, you know, and I think it was around, I wanted $25,000 or something, whatever it was, but it wasn't a big deal, and escalate to 35 and 45 or something like that. And the Cubs, you know, weren't budgeting and so forth, and I started the season unsigned, and so I'm playing, you know, I guess under old contract or whatever they do when they, at that time, what do they do?
They just renew it?
Renew it, yeah. Or whatever it was. Well, and that was in May, May 16th or 15th, somewhere around there. And I guess Montreal said, well, you know, we will sign him or trade for him if we could sign him or something like that. So anyway, they agreed to my contract offer. And so we're playing Montreal in Wrigley, and it was on a Sunday. And, you know, slid into third base, and I got started off a little slow that year, and slid into third base and jammed these two fingers real bad. After the game, I get a call from I don't know if it was Jim Marshall who called me or not, but and told me I was traded. Uh-huh. Okay.
Branko and Bittner.
Right, but actually it was, you know, I hadn't signed the contract. I was traded, so I had to sign with Montreal with the new contract. Mm-hmm. But anyway, Larry Bittner Steve Renko, was traded over there for those two guys, and McPhail agreed to the contract sign. That was on Monday, day off. Mm-hmm. Now, so I couldn't fly to Chicago, to Montreal with the Cubs, so I had to get a commercial flight to get to Montreal. Mm-hmm. Because the Cubs, you know, wouldn't let me on their charter, and. So that was the Monday, signed and everything, and Tuesday we played the Cubs. And I hit a home run that game, off Ray Burris, if I'm not mistaken.
Sure.
But my fingers never were right from then on. I had trouble with them, you know, all the rest of the time, and Montreal was a mess. You know, it was... we had Carl Keel, we had Jim Fox, I don't know, we may have had another manager in there or something, I don't know, but anyway.
It was just those two that year.
Yeah, it was a mess, but they had some good young talent.
Oh, Gary Carter.
Gary was on that team, Barry Foote was on that
sure.
team. They were kind of the young rookies, you know, coming up that, you know, they liked a little bit. They had Dawson in the minor leagues, Ellis Valentine.
Yeah. All of the parts of that 81 team
right.
were coming up. So
Cromartie was on that team, and Pete McCannon was on that team.
Sure.
Del Unser played on that team with us for a little bit. At one point, we had five first basemen. we had Big Earl Williams, who was catcher first baseman. We had Jurgensen, We had myself, we had Jose Morales, we had one guy from San Diego that came over, I forget his name, it was a big outfielder, first baseman. But it seemed like half the team was first baseman. You know?
And of course, you're in the National League. I mean, the DH had come in shortly before your career began.
Right.
But obviously not in the league you're in, so you hadn't thought about it at that time.
No, I hadn't. Well, the thing is, when I played with the Cubs against the Indians in spring training, I always killed them. And Frank was, you know, the manager. The year that I remember playing down there, because it was, I can't remember whether it was 75 or 76, but I was hitting them so well that Frank, I think, told Busby, I think Busby was with the, to hit me. And Busby broke a bone here, so I can't remember if that was 76 or 75 that started out the year. I started out on the disabled list. It might have been 75 or whatever. I forget now. It doesn't really matter. But I knew Frank liked me, and probably Sagi. That's probably where they saw me as well. So I knew I wasn't going to stay in Montreal. That was not a place for me.
So in December, you were traded to Cleveland
December,
for Jackie Brown.
December 10th.
Phil Sagi's best trade ever. How did you feel coming to Cleveland? It hadn't been a team with really any success over the last two decades prior.
Well, at that time, you're a young player. You're coming off a terrible year. You're not even worrying about how terrible Cleveland is. You just know it's a big league situation, you know.
But you are switching leagues. It's something completely different.
But, you know, I was young and confident, you know, and that type of thing. So I knew a couple guys over here and had played against some of the guys in the Portland when the Indians were, I think, out in Portland. So, you know, I knew a little bit about them. I knew it was a terrible place to go, but still it was the big leagues, you know, so that didn't bother.
And the expectation was that Boog Powell was running out of gas and that you would be the regular first baseman.
Well, that was, yeah, and at that time they had, when I got here, we had Boog that was in spring training, and they let him go in spring, I believe, and we had Bill Melton.
Yeah,
Bill was, and you know, of course, I remember Melton when he was in Chicago,
sure.
Having big years there. So those were the two guys that were kind of the leftovers, and then I was coming in, and I didn't know Frank personally, but you know, I got off to a slow start, you know, Frank, I guess, got a little impatient, but by the time you know, the All-Star break came around, and the rest of the year, I was hot as a firecracker.
And certainly by 77 through 79, you were on a power tear that you had not been at any point previously. What was the difference?
Well, but in the minor leagues, that's the way I displayed power. You know, I'd get on a hot streak, and I may hit 14 home runs in a 3-week span of time or something, or whatever it was. That's how I got called up to the big leagues, because, you know, that was kind of power spurt I was in. But it all came down to just playing. You know, I had not played basically since Wichita, because if since the 75 season ended in September, and so from then on it was kind of sporadic, you know, because we started the 76 season and start out slow, get traded to Montreal. It was spot playing through most of the year, and then when I got here, I started to, you know, again play again. All of a sudden you got in rhythm and had a good second half, and I think led the club in home runs that year. Yeah.
How much did working with Rocky Colavito help you?
Rocky was phenomenal. Rocky wasn't, you know, one of these guys that technician. Rocky was an aggressive hitter. He was see the ball, hit the ball, you know, be ready to hit type of thing, you know. But he was always positive. Rocky was was, and as a hitter, that's really all you need. You need people who are positive, who believe in what you're doing, and because if you, you know, you have the talent, or you wouldn't be there. But that's by the time I started getting playing, Tommy and Tom McGraw was there, and Rocky. And Rocky used to, you know, yell down to me from first base, and but Rocky played a big part in that, yeah. Just, you know, getting confidence, yeah.
I mean, he's not, he always has a sort of a quiet demeanor, or at least gives that impression, but among baseball people, I get the sense that he's very outgoing.
Well, Rocky was, I mean, he was very outgoing in the sense that he was confident about, he knew he could play, and he understood the game, you know, so when he got around that environment, yeah, Rocky was, you know, I enjoyed him. We had a decent coaching staff. It wasn't, you know, bad coaching staff at all.
So when you're with Cleveland and you have written about it, the accident that took your wife and your daughter, and you wrote a book called Triumph Born of Tragedy.
Mm-hmm.
And your Christian faith was, you know, the sudden snowstorm and high winds pushed the family van off the Pennsylvania Turnpike.
That's right.
And it's from what I've read, it sounds as though your Christian faith sustained you during this time and enabled you to get through this.
Oh, there's no doubt about it. I mean, because those are times that there is no explanation. There is no you're in a desert land. I mean, from the standpoint that you go from one minute that you're with your wife and daughter and son, and the next minute the coroner saying, "Mr. Thornton, we have your wife and daughter." I mean, you know, so. You know, that's when the life and the rubber meets the road. And so, you know, what you believe in needs to be real. And for me, that was where the rubber met the road. And that my faith, thank the Lord, that you know, was my wife and I, we both, you know, loved the Lord and believed in our Christian faith. When that happens, your faith is real. I mean, from the standpoint that you're not talking about theory anymore. You know, you're talking about reality, and the Lord certainly sustained us through that.
Yeah. And you had a young son, Andre Jr., who was in the back seat and survived.
And
you had to, as a single parent, to look after him right away. You didn't have time or you could not.
Right. You go back, and this is, you know, when I tell people, you know, how did you make it through? And, you know, one of the reasons that you know, we wrote the book was to because so many people were saying, how do you get through something like this? But you find out that the Lord gives you strength and he makes a way. And when you can't see it, even though you can't see it, he's preparing things to work out that all of a sudden you see things come into play, and they fall into place. But you can't say, well, I know that, you know, it's going to happen, but you feel that strength and you feel his guiding and his leading. Yeah.
So when you can't when you have a tragedy like that, and you can't explain why it happened to yourself,
mm-hmm.
Do you assume that God has a reason for it, and that you may not understand it, and that you just have to have faith in it, or why?
Well, the Bible teaches us that. I mean, from the standpoint, because we don't know why certain things. We can't put a why and a reason and an answer on everything that happens in life. But what our faith teaches us, John, is that the God of all creation. We're trusting in the God of all creation as our Savior to guide and direct our steps. So if he created all of this is, you know, you either believe that this just came out of nowhere or some Big Bang theory or explosion. You can believe that if you want. But I believe Scripture that God created this universe, And if he created this universe and he says he cares for me, then I believe that he is going to guide me through this maze that, we're in. Okay. So, yeah, my faith was not in circumstances. My faith was in, I don't know how you're going to do it. I don't know what tomorrow is going to look like. I don't know. I don't have the strength to make it through, but I'm trusting you. And so there were days when you're on your knees, you're praying, you're crying, and you know, sitting in the hotel room on a road trip, you feel the loneliness. There are no scripts that can lay it out. You know, well, what's happening? You just have to. To live through it and trust God that he'll bring you through it.
In 1978, you had a tremendous season. Mm-hmm. Were you able to focus on baseball? Was baseball in some ways a help to you because it allowed you to have something to concentrate on, or was it just something where you were reaching your peak years? What went into that?
Well, you know, even 77, I hit a number of home runs, and then 78, clearly, some good things fell into place. My power was becoming evident. Certainly, I was getting stronger, getting more confident in just my setting. I was here. I knew I was going to be here. I signed a 3-year contract here when I first got here. So it was just getting settled. But again, it was, Lord, I was up until, I remarried in November of that year. But, it was a year, like I said, you're crying and, I could sit in the hotel room, all of a sudden I start crying, or I feel the pain of the loss of loved ones, and feeling the strength of and love of people that were encouraging along the way, and had some good friends that certainly played a part in that.
The injuries started to pile up around this time, and around I know in 1980. You injured your knee in a spring training game, mm-hmm. and you obviously also mentioned the injury to your arm from being hit by the pitch. Mm-hmm. And whenever you played, you were productive. But mm-hmm. I know also that Cleveland sometimes was frustrated with your injuries. Mm-hmm. And can you describe a little bit of that dynamic of having to fight through these injuries?
I forget, was it 79, I guess, whenever it was, that the knee went out. I can't remember, but we're playing a spring training game.
I think it was 1980 that the knee went out.
Spring of 1980, right.
Yes.
And
it didn't heal correctly.
Well, what happened was Gabe wanted the surgery to take place as soon as possible. At that time, again, you didn't have second opinions and all of that stuff. It happened in spring training. Gabe felt that, if we can get this thing done, the guy from San Diego, San Diego was in Yuma, I think, somewhere. Somewhere Gabe was talking to this guy, and he said that he was a team doctor for San Diego, that, he'd do the surgery, go over to San Diego, he'd do the surgery, and then I'd be back in 5 or 6 weeks or 7 weeks or whatever. So, and again, it seems logical
and this was a cartilage problem for the most part.
And so the guy did not do arthroscopic surgery because that was just coming in as a new way of surgery. Well, this guy didn't do that. He did a half moon cut.
Oh.
It wasn't the full half moon that they used to do, but he kind of did a smaller version of that. Well, the thing about cartilage is that you can't see the back of the cartilage. You think you may have gotten all, but they didn't get all of the cartilage, the damaged cartilage out of the knee. And so I'm working to get back. and the knee's not getting any better. And Gabe is furious. He's, you're not working hard enough. You're not doing this. You should be back in the lineup. Blah, 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 blah. I was working out at Kent State. He was calling the people to see if I was showing up over there. Because we didn't have any facilities at the old Cleveland Stadium. Nothing. It was the worst situation in the world. Well, the guy told Gabe, the doctor, that they got all of the cartilage out. And so something must be wrong. He's just not pushing it hard enough. Well, the more I pushed it, the more it would tear up the lining in the knee. And so Gabe, by July, is furious. I'm going to suspend you if you don't get out there and play. Gabe, the knee will not bend past 90 degrees. Randy Hendricks, in a book he wrote, detailed the back and forth that we were having, because the Hendricks brothers were my agent with Gabe in that whole scenario. And at that time, it became a very tension-filled relationship. So Gabe's told them to send me up to hit. I think Dave Garcia might have been the manager at that time.
Yeah, it would have been at that time.
And so I'm on the on-deck circle in July and getting ready to hit, and somebody made the third out. Well, the next day, I had the knee re-examined and found out that the thing was all inflamed and messed up inside, and had to go back in, Brightman, at the Lutheran Hospital to clear out the damaged cartilage. And of course, at that point, I was through. That was, that ended the rest of the year, because at that point, the knee was in worse shape
than when you started.
Oh, very, very much so, because the whole time I'm trying to rehab and force this knee to go past 90 degrees, mm-hmm. it was just, tearing up the knee, and they couldn't understand what all of this was about.
And then in spring training of 81, you broke your hand.
That was
the strike shortened year, but at the same time you were injured. So.
I was injured. That was the strike year 81, whatever it was, and that's the year we had the All-Star game.
That's right. Len Barker's perfect game.
Was that Lenny's perfect game?
Yeah,
as well?
May of 81.
Okay. So. Well, yeah, that was against Toronto I remember that game.
You got a sacrifice fly?
That was the first run. That was the winning run.
A 3-0 game.
3-0 game. That was, I couldn't remember if that was a year. But anyway, yeah, that's how it all transpired. And Gabe and I, we didn't have a too good a relationship probably the rest of the way until he went back to New York.
Yeah. Well, thinking of Len Barker's perfect game, I mean, he was known for his erratic control, and he never had a game like that before or since.
Right.
I mean, we all know about him throwing the ball up on the screen in Texas.
Right.
And he got gradually stronger. I don't think he had a strikeout until the fourth inning, but finished with 11. Now, you were the DH that day.
Right.
So you were in the game, and tell me what you recall about Len Barker that particular day.
Well, like you said, I mean, nobody is thinking of anything normal. Lenny had good stuff. You could see, that as the game kept progressing, he kept, getting better, and nobody was hitting him. And, I think we had at that time maybe a one-run lead or something like that. But by the time you get to the seventh, something is happening. And you're not even thinking about perfect game, until I think somebody may have mentioned it on the bench when we were out in the field, and of course, as DH, I was in the dugout. But the excitement began to continue to build.
And people started to show up at the stadium.
Yeah, I can't remember that because, you know, I remember it was a kind of a dreary day.
It was a dreary Friday night.
Yeah, kind of like this. I mean, you know, it wasn't any big deal and not many people in the stands. I think we had about 6,000 people that really were there. But anyway, that's all you sensed is that, wow, you know, you start to, you know, get a little tension, you start to realize it. And Lenny started to feel it as well. I think he knew that he had great stuff that
His
night.
His curveball was very sharp.
Yeah, he knew he had great stuff that night, and he seemed like he had command of these guys, and it turned out to be a special evening, yeah.
And that lineup had, like, Danny Ainge was playing. It wasn't a formidable lineup, but there were a couple of balls that could have... I know Toby Harrah made a great catch near the stands, and I remember Kuiper made a play to his left that preserved it.
You don't remember much about the game because, you know, while you're in it... you're so certain things that you're concerned with, you know, you're not, but you go back and I've seen some of the replays now, you know, over the years and different things. But the biggest thing is that Lenny just had great stuff that night. I don't care who it might have been against, you know, he was just on that.
I think it was the first perfect game since Catfish Hunter in 68.
Is that right?
But
he was on, and he had that kind of stuff. And when he got his curveball working, you know, he had a great curveball, you know, but nobody was expecting that from Lenny because of his style. I mean, he was a little wild, you know, he threw a lot of pitches and that type of thing, and that just goes to show you we all have a little greatness at some point in time. Yeah.
Now, by this time, Mike Hargrove's come over from San Diego in the Paul Dade trade, mm-hmm. And he's going to be the regular first baseman. With your injuries, becoming a designated hitter is probably the sensible thing to do. I assume you were on board with it that time.
Well, yeah, I mean, at that point, Mike was a good first baseman, I didn't have any problem with that. I mean, that's what we needed from the standpoint. He was there because, you know, I didn't have the same ability that I used to have. It started to come back a little, but still different. But Mike was a good addition to our team.
The power. He was the average.
Well, yeah, Mike. I mean, you know, he was a solid hitter, and
occasionally batted leadoff as a first baseman, which was don't see every day.
Right, so you had Toby, Mike, and myself right there. So those were, you know, these guys were on base quite often, and I had some, you know, good years doing that stretch when we were together.
And of course, 82 was a very good year. You made your first All-Star team.
Yeah.
You know, and were Comeback Player of the Year after all of it. And you made a comment that, you know, if you were just healthy, you know, you've always produced when you're healthy.
It was 82 was a good year, and things went well, yeah.
So your power went down a bit in 83, but in 84, mm-hmm. you were back to normal. What happened between 82 to 83?
Well, 83, I think led the club in home runs, or tied with Gorman, I think, Thomas, I think. That was the year when Mike Ferraro came in here.
Yep.
I mean, we just had a mess of a club, you know, from the standpoint. It was the toughest thing for a professional athlete to do is to continue to motivate yourself through bad situations year after year after year.
By this time, you'd never finish, I think, higher than fifth.
Right. So you're really, we just didn't have the club. And I always got off to a slow start. I mean, the worst thing in the world is come back from spring training to the kind of weather that we were coming back to and trying to
not
trying
baseball to weather.
Yeah. And I was a warm weather player, but anyway, you know, I think my average was probably better that year. I think I hit 270 or something that year with 17 something home runs, I think, or whatever, 60 or, but anyway, you know, nothing special other than the fact that Mike I believe it's that year, where he got sick and he had to leave. When did Corrales come in?
I want to say 80, because that would be after Garcia, right? And before, no, that would be after Ferraro, right?
Right.
So that would be 84.
Yeah, because
84, 85, somewhere.
Yeah, I think we had Mike for a short period of time, and then.
I think he was only there for a year, if I remember correctly.
Yeah, so. And then he got sick, and then that's Corrales came in, but anyway, 83 was just a good year, but not a great year. And then the next year, things got back, and I can't remember. You know, you go back and you look through these years, and I never go back and try to analyze. You know, that's a lifetime ago. You know, for me, it's I enjoyed playing sports. I knew it wasn't something that I would be in career in. It was a job. You know, that's the way I looked at it. It was a job, and because there was never a whole lot of fun here. You know, it wasn't like you're winning and you're fun and all of those kind of. It was work.
Yeah,
I mean, it was.
And they never really had another power hitter in the lineup. I think in '78, the second leading home run hitter was Gary Alexander, who had, I think, 17.
Right.
I think in '83, I think you tied for the team leading home runs with 17 with Gorman Thomas.
Right.
But there never was really that guy. And I think in the '81 strike shortened year, no one hit 10.
Yeah, because I think I had 7 that year. those are things that, you know, it's like getting drafted out of college in football now and going with a bad team. It's work. I mean, it's not like you're jubilant every day. You're coming to the ballpark, you know it's drudgery. You know that this is not going to be easy.
When you became a free agent in 84, mm-hmm. you re-signed. You know, you could have gone somewhere else. By this time, I think in your Cleveland career, you never finished higher than 4th. Mm-hmm. But you still came back when you could have gone somewhere else.
Well, that's an interesting situation because I had no intention of coming back. Mm-hmm. You got to remember, I went down, and this is a story that very few people know, is that I had that year in 84 or 80, no, 82, 83 was a down year. Well, that January, I went to a golf school in Sun City, Florida. Gabe Paul was in Tampa. And so I said, Gabe, I'm going to be in Florida. And if I'm not mistaken, I think that was the last year of my contract or whatever it was, or I had one more year in the contract, and I said, well, Gabe, do you want to talk about an extension, or what are we going to do? And so we're in Florida, and I came up from Sun City, wherever that is down there now, and so Gabe and I are in this restaurant, and he says, nope, I'm not thinking about signing you beyond this year. I said, then I'll play out this year and I'll move on because I'm only going to play for maybe 3 more years at that point. And that was a conversation just like we were sitting across from one at dinner. And so I went out in '84 and had a monster year. And at that time, Gabe was, I think he eventually moved to New York. Was it during that year or at the end of that year?
I think it was the end of the year.
Yeah. Well, anyway, Gabe was caught in a pickle because now all of a sudden the Indians, I think Bavese came in, and they didn't know what to do. I think Bavese was trying to get the club to move or something.
That's right.
Because it was again.
The stadium was falling apart.
Yeah, turmoil. They didn't know what they were going to do, and so I remember the Hendricks brothers and I. We were in a meeting with the owner of the Orioles at that time was a lawyer, I forget his name, but Lucchino, I think the guy that was with the Red Sox,
yep,
was his number two guy.
Right, yeah.
Was it Bennett Williams? No. But he was a lawyer that owned the club.
Oh, Edward Bennett Williams?
Was he the guy?
Yeah.
Well, he was a lawyer that owned the team. And my brother-in-law, Pat Kelly, played with the Orioles. And
sure,
so he had been talking to Pat
left-handed
about...
Left-handed hitter.
Yeah, how are we going to get Andre to come to Baltimore and be the DH here? Because I think they were moving away from Ken Singleton at that point. Something, I don't know. But anyway, so we're sitting down in a suite in Houston at whatever the hotel was. And so our deal was, we said, well, we want, what did we want? We said, well, we want whoever gives us a four-year contract, the first one that offers a four-year contract is who we're going to sign with. And so we're sitting down at Hank Peters. That's probably why, you know, we never did get along, Hank Peters, I guess. Because what he got here, the first guy he called is me and said, well, I think we're going to go in a different direction. But anyway, Frank Peters and the Williams, I guess the lawyer, and Lucchino, whoever, I think it's Lucchino, but we're in the hotel room, and he said, we'll offer you a three-year contract. And at that time, said, well, we'll defer money at no interest and that type of thing. We said, no, you're crazy. He said, well, we do that with all our players.
Yeah.
I said, well, you're not going to do it with us. And I said, if we defer any money, it is, you're going to pay interest on it and so forth. And so they offered a three-year contract. And it was, you know, the conversation was going. We probably would have, you know, got what we were wanting out of that, but Peters didn't want to go for a four-year contract.
Mm.
And I said, well, you know, we'll continue to talk to some other teams. At this point, he said, well, you know, let's talk again tomorrow. And I think I would have eventually got the four-year contract. Well, Peter Bavese saw us coming out of the Orioles room, because all the teams, you know, had the headquarters there on the various floors, and so he and Sagi saw us coming out of the room, and at that time they were getting pressure. Well, you're going to get rid of your best player. How are you going to be competitive and blah, 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 blah. That was happening in Cleveland in the papers and all of this is going on. And so they said, well, what did they offer you? I said, well, you know, they look like they're going to give us what we want. And we'll offer you a four-year deal right now. Because we told them, I said, the first team that offers a four-year deal is who we're going to sign with. And they offered the four-year deal and gave us what we were looking for and deferred the money at 9.5% interest and it all worked out fine and the next morning we saw Frank Peters. He was furious. Because, you know, he thought we were going to work something out. I told him, you know, when we sat down with him, we said, well, you know, we don't play around. This is it. I mean, we're not coming in here to negotiate. And he said, well, that's not how we do things. And next thing you know, we were signed back with Cleveland. And I didn't finish out the contract, but...
Finished out three of the four.
Yeah, three of the four.
And there was some reason for optimism at this time. I mean, there have been a lot of players coming and going. I mean, you had the Julio Franco trade, got rid of John Denny, who went on to win the Cy Young. Bly Levin left.
Right.
Then they had the Sutcliffe deal that brought in Joe Carter.
Right.
Corey Snyder shows up.
Right. But all of those guys were kind of unproven at that point.
So you were the veteran on a team
of
young, unproven guys. I mean,
right.
So.
But the city was the one that they were getting a lot of pressure from the league and the city and everybody else, I guess, because, what are you doing with this team? Where are you going and all that? I guess a lot of that was going on. But as far as I was concerned, I told Gabe, I said, Gabe, you had a chance, we never did get along great. I guess I didn't talk to him a whole lot. But.
Did you? Obviously, things sort of turned in terms of production for you at the end of the '87 season, mm-hmm. and I think you probably had a sense that it was time to hang him up.
Especially
since they had a really tough year in '87 anyway.
Well, remember in '87, I didn't play very much in '87.
Yeah,
some people thought I retired in '86, but no, '87. I think I had less than 100 at bats.
That's right. Yeah.
Pat Corrales. I said, Pat, and this is the only time I thought about potentially staying in baseball. I said, Pat. Early in the year, I said, because they wanted to put, I think, Tabler or somebody out at first base or designated hitter, they were thinking about cutting back my playing time. And I said, Pat, I'm signed. I'm on a long-term contract with these guys. I said, well, if you decide to go this way, then make that decision, and I could help out in the front office or something, was it O'Brien that was the general manager at that time? Wasn't there? I want to say O'Brien. Was it O'Brien? Who was the general manager? Because Sagie had passed away.
Yeah.
I want to say O'Brien, but something like that. But anyway, and I told Pat, I said, well, you got the fans that, I've lived here, become at least recognizable and have a good reputation here. And if I'm sitting and just sitting, that's going to put more pressure on you. I said, well, why don't we just make a decision? If that's the way that you want to go, then I'll step aside. And he didn't, they didn't make it. And I talked with O'Brien at that point that, I'd be glad to work for the club in some capacity. You're paying me for the next 15 years.
Okay.
They didn't seem to want to do anything that way, and so I told Pat, I said, Pat, they're going to fire you before, at the All-Star break. That's just the way it goes. You're going to take, you're going to be the scapegoat on this thing. And they did, and they fired him, I think, at the All-Star break and brought in Doc Edwards.
That's right.
I remember Doc from my Philadelphia days. I mean, that's how far we went back. But
what happened to that '87 team? It was on the cover of Sports Illustrated. Everybody thought this was the year. They had young people like Greg Swindell coming up, and it lost 100 games.
Well, again, you look at, well, you just had the culture at that point. Like I said, I got less than 100 at bats at that point. They're trying to figure out what they're doing. Nothing worked. Corey turned out not to be the hitter that they thought he was going to be. The pitching was so-so, but nothing worked. And it was a miserable year. Yeah, mm-hmm. It was a miserable year.
Now, I want to make sure that you're okay on time. I wanted to just wrap up with a few things, if that's okay with you.
Yeah, I got to get ready to go. Yeah.
Okay, I wanted to ask you just a couple of two things. We hadn't covered your cycle in '78. I wanted to go back to that against Boston, where you got four hits off of four different pitchers. Mm-hmm. And, you know, given that you were not known for your speed, the triple early in the game. And I just wondered if you could describe that, because that is an uncommon occurrence, especially for a number four hitter.
Well, all I remember about that time is that, I think I went into that game hitting 100 or something, or 120, but I was struggling early in the season. I didn't know who I hit the home runs off of, the hits off of, but somebody said it was four different pitchers. I didn't know. All I was glad to see is they were hits. You know, that was the thing.
They wound up being Alan Ripley, Bob Stanley, Jim Wright, and Tom Bergmeier.
All right, Bergmeier was a left-hander, but Stanley was, I hit Stanley well all of my career when he played with Boston.
His pitches broke inside, right?
He threw a flat slider, but just some pitchers you hit well and some you don't. But he was one that no matter what he threw, I hit. The home run was the home run. The other hits were just a double and single. The triple hit in the corner of the center field, right field, where
that little angular part of the...
And ricocheted one way or the other, I forget, but... and that it really turned out to be a pretty easy triple, from that standpoint, because of I thought the ball was going out of the ballpark, that started to turn that season around. April of '78, ended up then turning out to be a great year.
I wondered if you could briefly describe for me how you got to become CEO and chairman of ASW Global. I know for a while you owned a chain of Applebee's restaurants after you retired.
Yeah.
And if you could just briefly describe how you got from there to here.
Well, when I left the game, I finished up my schooling. I had started years before and then graduated from Capital University. The Cleveland Center is where I took my courses from here. Capital's out of Columbus. But when I left the game, I had been involved in the city and various things, and I had a good friend, Gordon Heffern, who was the chairman of Society Bank. And Gordon, encouraged me, why don't you stay here and after your career go into business and that type of thing. I was always geared toward, doing something in the business arena or entrepreneurial arena. So I'm sitting down at our retirement when Jacobs bought the club. Well, a couple of guys that worked for Jacobs were friends of mine, Tom DeNome and Richard Adler. Both of them, Tom worked directly for Jacobs, and Richard was the broker for their real estate. Uh-huh. So we're sitting down and said, let's go into business. We know finance, we know marketing, we know blah, 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 all this stuff. And so we put together an investment group, and we bought a couple restaurants in St. Louis, Missouri, and built another 11 there, and bought the rights to Portland, and built a few there, and then Applebee's got in a takeover battle and needed to buy back as many stores as they could, as quickly as they could. And our stores were some very successful stores, and nice timing. things worked out, and we sold the stores back to Applebee's because they needed them very badly. And so we had a 7-year exit strategy. We got out in 6, and then bought another company, which was a procurement and e-fulfillment company. I built that company up, and then a company out of Akron, ASW Global, which was part of the company that we merged our two companies, and I bought controlling interest of that in 2007. And today we, you know, we manage a little over 1 million square feet in this area here in Northeast Ohio, and you know, employ a little over 200 people in this region, and so that's we are a warehouse and logistics operation. So we, you know, we do business all over the world. We're foreign trade zone, so we break bulk in our facilities. We're considered an inland port, so you can ship right from anywhere in the world to our location without ever having to go through customs or to pay duty on those. You go through customs, but you don't pay duty on those products until they leave our facility. So I was always geared, you know, when they tell you they don't need you anymore, you find other ways to do things. So these were the areas that I felt, you know, that worked well for me from a talent standpoint, and you know, working with people and looking for opportunities was something that fit me very well.
Andre Thornton, we are grateful for you taking this time for our Sabre Oral History, and wish you continued success.
Well, thanks, John. I appreciate it.